people's statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas to improve government effectiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For over a decade, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring independent third-party research on a broad range of public management topics, topics and issues important to public sector executives. Today, we will profile three IBM Center reports that explore such questions as, what is cloud computing? How can states use process improvement methods to transform their service delivery? And when to use geographical information systems to enhance citizen engagement? We'll talk with three of our authors who have performed in-depth research in these areas and offer their extended reflections on such questions. First up, moving to the cloud. An Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by Professor David Wild of Southeastern Louisiana State. Professor Wild joins us now. Professor, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Professor, the term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press talking excitedly about this concept. Your report for the IBM Center examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing and why it's receiving such increased attention. Dr. Wild, what is cloud computing?
Well, that is a good question today, and sometimes the definition depends on vendor perspectives because they will try to say what we're offering, what we may have been offering for 10 years, now is a cloud product. But basically, in a nutshell, cloud computing is the ability to draw computing resources on demand from the web anytime, anywhere, so long as you have an internet connection and a web browser. And so what it really does is change the whole paradigm of computing from I need to have a powerful desktop, powerful servers within my organization in order to do what I need to do, to where I change the perspective of I'm drawing on the resources I need at the time, but also freeing myself to be able to do work basically anywhere, anytime, from any location, so long as I do have an internet connection.
In a nutshell, the idea of cloud computing is that computing will become location and device independent. What are some of the other benefits of cloud computing?
Well, there's a number of benefits to cloud computing. The first, kind of to reiterate the fact that it enables you to have great computing resources available at your fingertips wherever you may be working and whatever type of machine you may be working from. Some of the other benefits come into play in terms of the economics of the cloud, because what it means is that you don't necessarily have to have every computing resource that your organization will ever need. Take, for instance, the IRS. They do not have to have all the computing resources available that would only be needed April 13th, 14th, and 15th of every year. They can rationalize their computing resources based on a year-long pattern of demand, and when they encounter those peak times, they can draw upon additional servers, additional storage. Same thing with universities and research institutions. Rather than having all the computing resources available that researchers might need at any given time, they can draw upon those resources as needed. And what's shocking is to find the lack of utilization of computing resources. And so really what we're seeing is a real rationalization of computing resources through the move to cloud computing.
Cloud computing is still an emerging model. Your report and research identified 8 fundamental elements that are vital to enabling the cloud concept to not just exist, but to grow to its fullest potential. Would you outline those eight fundamental elements of cloud computing?
Well, the first is you have to have universal connectivity. You have to be able to connect to cloud resources from wherever you are. It has to be accessible. It has to be reliable, and reliability is a huge issue today. Imagine if you're in the federal government and your agency information may not be available for any length of time. Those type of security and reliability issues come to the fore. The fourth element is interoperability and user choice. And what I mean by that is that you have really a choice of what platform, what device you're going to be accessing the cloud from. What that means is that I can access the same computing resources, see the same interface, be able to have the same computing power regardless of what type of machine, what type of operating system, or where I'm located. And from a value perspective, what that also means is the shelf life of our computing resources we're used to today in our businesses and in government and in our personal lives. The day you take the computer out of the box, it's out of date. Well, with cloud computing, that's not going to be the case, because as long as you have the web browsing capabilities that are current, you can access the most current versions of software. And it really also rolls into the fifth element, which is security. You know, there's kind of this mentality from an IT perspective that if I hold the data within my organization, it's going to be more secure than if it's located off-site. Well, as we've seen with disasters and so forth, you need to have that redundancy built in. The sixth element deals with privacy, and privacy is certainly at the forefront of concerns with cloud computing. It's often one of the potential vulnerabilities that critics of cloud computing can attack the whole cloud idea on, because there's this concept that there's going to be the capability to hack into data more easily and so forth. What we find is that oftentimes we inflate our organization's own security capabilities, and by doing so, we kind of fool ourselves into saying we have a much more secure environment than our competitors, than our other agencies, and so forth. Well, truth be told, because the cloud computing vendors, they invest massive resources in not just data security measures, but physical security measures and redundancies. And so what we've seen is that from a privacy perspective and from a security perspective, cloud offers a better way of computing. The seventh value deals with the economics. And as we've talked about before, computing resources can last longer via a cloud model. We're not having to buy and procure every server, every bit of capacity that we ever need. Even though storage is unbelievably cheap today, we can rationalize where we store data, how it's accessible through the cloud model. And so what we've seen is that the early implementations of cloud computing, both in the private sector and in the public sector, have significant ROI built into them. The final thing is sustainability. This is a little bit of a concern, and one of the reasons that there sometimes is more of a hybrid model of cloud computing where, well, I'm going to engage with an outside vendor for cloud storage, for programs, and so forth, but I want to maintain some resources on site. So one thing we've seen is that there is a push toward the bigger players, the more established players. I can invest my resources with them and know I have a much more stable and sustainable model to follow and work with them for the long term. So there's a great deal of foundational security to the cloud computing marketplace.
Dr. Wild, the developments in cloud computing are leading many inside and outside the public sector to ask if it works for business, why not for government? Well, your report does a wonderful job of outlining specific case studies of how cloud computing is being used presently across the public sector. Would you give us an overview of those more compelling illustrations of cloud computing in the public sector?
I think what we've seen is that we're still in the early stages of all of this. And one thing that is central to how cloud is going to develop in the federal space is certainly the leadership of CIO Vivek Kundra. You know, he proved the value of cloud in his time as CTO of the District of Columbia. And, you know, moving to the district to Google Apps, opening up district data, running contests to see, you know, how data could be better utilized and allowing citizens and programmers to participate in those. So we have a real champion in Mr. Kundra to guide the federal development. Certainly some of the more fascinating stuff that's being done is being done from a business side with the GSA in terms of creating a real storefront for cloud computing to be more widely adapted in the federal space. Their apps.gov becomes a central clearinghouse for, hey, I have a data issue, a computing issue that I need to address. Let me go to apps.gov and see if there is a cloud app that I can use for my particular situation. NASA has been at the forefront of all of this. They've created a cloud that's called the Nebula Cloud, borrowing on some rich language for their purposes. But the Nebula Cloud is very interesting in terms of consolidating NASA's computing resources and enabling them to draw upon a centralized cloud capability. And it's also interesting because NASA sees this as a way to involve the public more in the space program and draw more interest. And certainly at a time where, you know, there's been some controversy about where we go forward in terms of the space program, their cloud effort is central to their strategy going forward for their entire organization. And certainly, we can't ignore what's going on in the DoD and the military space. There's been some very interesting uses of cloud from DISA, the Defense Information Systems Agency, and across the U.S. Army in terms of their recruitment efforts as well.
And yet, Dr. Wild, the whole notion of cloud computing is not without its detractors. Would you tell us more about the critics of cloud computing and what motivates them?
Well, I think there's two main motivations for the critics of cloud computing. The first are those that are concerned about the security and the privacy aspects, because they see this almost as, according to Richard Stallman, who's the founder of the Free Software Foundation, he sees cloud computing as a trap, that we're going to get away from this decentralized model of computing that's evolved over time and revert back to something like, you know, the 1950s, 1960s with the heydays of the mainframe computer, and that as we become more and more dependent on cloud resources, admittedly, you know, today many of these cloud resources that people and organizations are drawing upon are free resources. You know, anyone who's using Gmail or one of the picture sharing services and so forth is in the clouds and may not realize it. As we use more and more cloud services in our daily lives and our work lives, we're going to become more dependent on those cloud providers. And the argument is, as we go back to a more centralized form of computing, then those who control the cloud will control pricing, and that we'll become dependent upon them and their resources for our very, you know, livelihoods. And I think that economic argument fails in comparison to those who criticize the cloud from the security and the privacy perspectives, because there are significant criticisms of cloud over the fear that because you're maintaining resources, important data in these centralized repositories, often, you know, perhaps outside of the U.S., then there's concern over how secure is that data? Can I be able to reliably access it over the long term? With transmission of the data between the cloud and my own computer, is there a greater chance of it being hacked, of it being stolen, of it being intentionally corrupted, and so forth? So there are some concerns, but what I can say is that after about 18 months of investigation and working with cloud providers and customers, the lengths that have been gone to and will continue to be done to assure that cloud utilization is even more secure than, you know, having data on your laptop that's carried through airport security that may or may not make it through the other end, it's a far more secure environment.
Dr. Weil, what are some of the significant challenges facing government leaders as they work to integrate cloud computing into their IT strategy?
Well, I think we've talked a good bit today about the security and reliability issues, and so I'll move on to some of the other issues. And one issue that is important, particularly in the federal space, is that the government is going to be a huge buyer in the cloud computing market. And as such, they can exert a great deal of not just regulatory power, but market power in shaping how the cloud market is going to evolve and what products and services are going to be out there. And so, yes, there's going to be a need to regulate cloud computing, but government as a huge buyer, not just at the federal level, but at the state and local levels and internationally, will be an important force in the cloud marketplace. Certainly, there's going to be legal issues that are going to arise, and we're encountering already some interesting cases that our law is going to have to evolve to meet the needs of the cloud computing environment that we live in today. I think one of the more exciting things about all this is, you know, that we can demonstrate a good return on investment by shifting to cloud resources. You know, if we're talking about the move to e-government, this certainly, I think, it makes that faster. And as governments around the world have seen, we've seen cases from, there's a very interesting case brought in the report dealing with the government of Japan and some of their coordinated efforts. The government of the United Kingdom has a huge cloud undertaking right now. And what we're seeing is that the move toward cloud is demonstrated based on we're able to do more in challenging budget times by investing in cloud computing. The final thing I'll talk about is how this changes the nature of IT work. I mentioned earlier in the interview about no longer having to worry about manual upgrades of every computer in your organization to have the latest software, the latest security software, and so forth, with the cloud taking care of that from the remote locations. What's interesting is that as we advance in the cloud model and we make strides toward where more and more computing is done via cloud resources, it's really going to change the nature of IT in the organization and change for the better the nature of IT work. There's a question whether do we need less people in IT? And in the short term, the answer will probably be yes, because there's going to be a decline in the need for organizations to have that shop where all the broken computers go to and people have their hands in boxes and trying to do that type of work. There's going to be less need for the people to run around and do manual upgrades on 500 computers in an agency location in Oklahoma City. But there's going to be more demand for higher level IT work in terms of education and training and writing the contracts and evaluating bids for cloud computing resources. So we're going to have less hands-on work in the IT area and more value-added work in the IT area.
Let's focus on next steps that public managers can take. Would you outline your cloud migration strategy?
I outline a six-step process that I call the cloud migration strategy. And the first step is learning. And through reading the report that's free and available on the web through the IBM Center for the Business of Government is an excellent place to start. There's plenty of great resources out there on the web for learning about cloud computing. So it can be a very no-cost proposition to learn more about it. The second step, though, is to assess your own organization. What are your IT needs? What's your IT utilization? You need to come up with a real honest IT baseline. And what organizations often find is in looking inward, they're shocked in terms of how little their computing resources are utilized, often finding that their server utilization might be 3 to 5%. And so why do we have 95% of the capacity that we have if it's sitting there idle 95% of the time? And so I think that is a step every organization should take today, because they need to see how they're using not just their servers, but their desktops, their laptops, how much of computing resources are really, really being utilized. The third step is to pick a specific project and try a cloud pilot. Again, I would urge, don't try 10 different projects, but concentrate on one pilot area in terms of how we can use cloud resources in the organization. One of the fascinating things that I found and continue to learn about through my ongoing research into cloud computing is how many organizations are in the cloud and don't know it. You know, quite honestly, employees that use social networking tools, that use photo sharing sites in their own work, they use Google Apps for their own documents, all of a sudden there's a real merger between what they're doing in their private lives and what they're doing in their work lives. Particularly, in the federal sector, we always talk about the challenge of recruiting and retaining the best workers. Well, cloud resources are something that younger workers in particular expect to see today. They cannot see how to do their jobs without it. So it's a real almost HR issue today, not just an IT issue in terms of holding on to workers. The fourth step is, after you have done a cloud pilot, assessed how it works for your organization, then you really need to look wider throughout the organization, building upon that IT baseline study that you've done, and see, where does this fit? Are there programs? Are there applications? Is there data that is cloud eligible? On the other hand, are there things that are cloud ineligible that have to be maintained in-house? And so if you look at data from a security standpoint and so forth, certainly there are elements that are going to be cloud ineligible. The fifth step is to really begin a serious cloud rollout strategy. Gain buy-in from your users, from your IT people. The users are often the easiest ones to convince, because if what's on their desktop, if what's on their laptop is better than what they had, they're gonna love you. Finally, we enter a stage where, borrowing upon my management background, I call it continuous cloud improvement, where you try to learn about what you can do better with cloud computing, learn what other organizations are doing in the cloud area, and benchmark and model their best practices. And certainly, I'm a firm believer that the public sector should benchmark the private sector, and in the private sector can learn a great deal from what the federal and state and local governments are doing in terms of their cloud models and utilization. Experts have said we're really just at the tip of the iceberg right now.
Dr. Weil, that's a wonderful perspective, and I want to thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you and your audience today.
As we look into the immediate horizon, one could well imagine that in 5 to 10 years, we may not even be speaking of the cloud or cloud computing anymore. And this is because using what we now regard as cloud services may simply become the way things are done. How did the state of Louisiana improve human service delivery? When we return to this special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, we will explore this and more with Dr. Vicki Grant.
Check out the new Fall-Winter 2009 issue of the Business of Government magazine. Don't miss conversations with leaders. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, discusses infectious diseases such as the 2009 H1N1 flu virus and other emerging and re-emerging infectious disease. Admiral Thad Allen, Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, explains his successful use of social media tools, Coast Guard modernization, and the U.S. Arctic policy. Order or download a free copy of the Fall-Winter 2009 The Business of Government magazine by going to thebusinessofgovernment.org.
Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improve government effectiveness. Typically, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has chronicled stories of complex, large-scale organizational transformations, such as those in the Departments of Defense and Veterans Affairs. But it is also important to tell the stories of those frontline leaders who have made a difference on a smaller scale. We now turn to another IBM Center report, Transforming State Government Services Through Process Improvement, a case study of Louisiana, by Dr. Vicki Grant. This report is a firsthand story of common sense management, using basic process management techniques to redesign a vital element of human service delivery. Dr. Grant joins us now. Dr. Grant, would you provide us with an overview of your report?
Okay, certainly. The report is about the state of Louisiana's journey over more than a decade of trying to increase access to health care coverage for the uninsured in their state. And they have made phenomenal progress, Louisiana being one of the poor southern states that oftentimes, like other southern states, is on the wrong side of the indicators. Shortly after Hurricane Katrina, the Medicaid eligibility director contacted me and said, we have to rebuild our system, but I want to rebuild an improved system. So the report focuses on their now five-year journey into process improvement and really focusing on how they can teach their workforce to become critical thinkers, increase their staff capacity without adding staff, and become very, very customer-centered.
Dr. Grant, what prompted you to pursue this research?
I have been working with the state for a long time, and after Ruth Kennedy contacted me and we had such phenomenal results in our work together, Ruth and I both wanted other state governments to know the possibilities. When you engage in process improvement, it can be a low-cost endeavor, really developing your workforce. And we wanted to let other states know that it was possible. We had heard many of what we call the myths of why I can't do it now. And so many states spend so much time fighting fires, and the recession has been a firestorm that they can hardly lift their heads over. And many just think that it's not possible or practical at this time. And we wanted to show for one state that there is a path forward that they can take.
In your report, Dr. Grant, you describe a step-by-step process used by a frontline agency leader to make a huge difference for thousands of beneficiaries of Louisiana's public health care system. First, what is process improvement?
Well, process improvement is a method of looking at your system, identifying problems, and choosing and implementing solutions to that. And it comes in many forms. Some of the more popular ones now are lean thinking, and we utilized a lot of those principles, although it began in manufacturing. Toyota has made it very popular. Many hospitals are adapting many of those same methods, and we use those. Another is Six Sigma. We referenced that from time to time. It wasn't the methodology that we followed. Our primary methodology for improving the process was developed by Dr. Edwards Deming and others, called the Plan, Do, Check Act, or, as it's been modified, the Plan, Do, Study Act. And it's a very simple method that frontline workers can learn quickly and implement quickly. So it's not a resource-intensive method for making improvements on the front line and in statewide policy.
Your report outlines six actions that were taken by Ruth Kennedy. Would you outline for us the six actions?
As Louisiana focused on how to improve the process, they were aware that they needed to do a number of things. One was to train many of their workers and how to look at process differently. And that is what we call the Louisiana Eligibility Process Improvement Collaborative, which is a learning method. But there were six other steps that Louisiana took. One is to begin to view work as a process. So often we see people whose job they feel is to manage people rather than manage a process. When you begin to view work as a series of steps and that each step deserves to be examined to see if it really adds value to what you're trying to do, or does it really add impediments? Is there waste in the system? So viewing work as a process is very important. And one of the tools that you can use for that is becoming more popular in social services now is what's called process mapping or value stream mapping, in which you just simply lay out all of the steps that are taken and look at the data associated with those steps to help you focus on the real problem areas. A second thing that Louisiana did was they redesigned how workflows in local offices, how eligibility workers, clerical staff, mid-level managers, how they do their work. And in that regard, we pulled a lot from the lean thinking and the proven practices in that field. A third thing, and it's critical, and Louisiana did this very well, is they focused on the customers. Louisiana sought a win-win position for their clients and their workers. So they did surveys. They began to talk to customers about the process. They understood them. They tried to learn and did learn what service do they really want and under what conditions do they want it. Well, they apply for Medicaid or CHIP coverage, and they want that coverage if they're eligible, and they want it quickly. So Louisiana focused on how they could help the customers obtain that. One of the critical factors in any endeavor to improve a process is to have data on the process and to analyze that data and look at it. One of the things that is very beneficial is when workers can begin to look at data as not a measure of accountability or something for which they may be blamed, but when data becomes a tool so that they can see objectively what they're doing and look at ways to improve. It's just essential that there be data on how work flows and on customer demand. Another important use of the data are to provide to the full workforce the data in a way that gives them feedback on their performance and communicates. Ruth Kennedy was excellent at connecting dots for her workforce. We've known for years and years that early prenatal care reduces infant mortality and morbidity. And she was able to connect the dot that for a pregnant woman, if you process her application quickly and she's eligible, she can get prenatal care much earlier in her pregnancy, and the likelihood of a good birth outcome is much greater. So she used that data to communicate with her staff statewide and to help them understand that what they're doing, the importance of their work, and how it fits into the lives of others. Many caseworkers, and I would say most, come to these jobs because they want to help someone. So the data and process improvement help workers reconnect to their original purpose. It makes them happier, and it reduces the stress.
Dr. Grant, that's an excellent example of the benefit of doing process improvement. Were there any other benefits you'd like to share with us as a result of this initiative?
Well, one benefit that still lives on till today is that they were able to add capacity, not add staff. During an 18-month period, they had approximately a 25% reduction in their workforce. This was in the time period of June 2008 to January 2010. And with that incredible reduction in their field staff, they actually increased their productivity. They were able to do this because they had eliminated many procedures that no longer added any value to the workers, to the quality of the work, or to their clients. They've been able to increase the proportion of people who usually are on Medicaid for a year and then they have to renew their eligibility. They were able to increase the number of those eligible who were retained at that period. In many, many states, too many people are discontinued at renewal. Then they come back within the next month or the next month and reapply. So that rework, so to speak, Louisiana has largely eliminated. Another important benefit, I think, was, and it wasn't one that was a goal of the original project, but has occurred, is the state office began to see more and more folks at the local level who were taking initiative to really improve the process. Of the original group of 60 to 80 people who started in the Process Improvement Collaborative, many of them now have been promoted once, twice, three times. So it began to give them something to build into the career path. If you want promotions, then one of the things that you need to do is take responsibility for your work, be customer-centered, and help everyone in your office and statewide look at better ways to perform our jobs.
Any effort and any endeavor of such breadth and scope faces significant challenges. What were some of the challenges, those major challenges that you saw as a result, and how did you overcome them?
A major challenge of this size is resistance to change. What Louisiana did is they changed their culture from one of where field staff always looked to the state to say, tell us what to do. And Louisiana changed the model and said, the state changed the model and said, you know best. Here are the ways we can learn best practices by your doing the plan, do, study, act cycles and really learning from data what works better. And many of the local process improvement teams were able to have significant impact on statewide policy by doing testing, looking at the results, sharing with others, and the state would say, that is a much better way to do this. Let's all try to do it. The state moved somewhat out of the position of the controlling command center to one of, we are your partners. We will give you resources, not financial, but we will give you time and training to learn better ways. Your job is to do that, share it with others. So it was a major change in culture, and there were many people who had been there for years who resisted change until they sort of got caught up into this movement of there really are better ways to do things. Just because we've done it this way for years does not mean that it's the best way.
So with any major transformation, like what you just outlined, leadership is critical for it to be successful. So how important was leadership to the success of this effort in Louisiana?
Had it not been for the leadership, some gains may have been made, but nothing like what they have achieved. Ruth Kennedy has been a leader in her state, and she is a sought after speaker across the nation for what they have accomplished. I give so much credit to Ruth for just having a relentless focus on providing the best service to clients possible and to getting those who are eligible into a health coverage program so that they can actually access medical services. But I don't want to not talk about her executive staff and others. They were great resources to her, to the local level, from those over data systems to all of the managers. It was a really good working team. And as a state asked field staff to begin to learn to think differently and to test ideas, the state also asked its own staff. So the state and field staff were working with the same methods, same set of knowledge, and sharing that over and over and over. Leadership is a funny kind of thing. It's not just I get to make the decisions and tell you how to do your job. Ruth encouraged and sought a way for all to become involved and taking responsibility for doing work in a better way and a faster way and one that has quality results with very few, if any, errors. Leadership is also the thing that sustains you, and the executive team did this. As the economy changes, leadership is the one who says, we're going to keep our focus on continuous improvement. We won't let our focus on that decline as other fires begin to jump up.
Dr. Grant, your IBM Center report shows that while technology helps, it is in fact leadership that matters. We hope that this report serves as a useful guide and inspiration for public managers across the government as they pursue ways to better deliver services to their citizens.
I would like for other states and large organizations, as well as county governments, to realize that process improvement is within their capacity. During this recession, it might be difficult, but it is not impossible. What Louisiana has found is, as the recession hit, they were more flexible, could adapt quicker because of this learning environment that had been created. It is very powerful. It's a way for state governments to build better partnerships with their hands-on field staff. And in that way, it produces the benefits for the clients, and it produces a better prepared and happier workforce.
You can download a copy of Transforming State Government Services Through Process Improvement, a Case Study of Louisiana, and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Grant.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to tell the Louisiana story, both in terms of the written report and this interview. I appreciate very much having this chance to get the word out, and I certainly encourage the listeners to take a look at the report, to contact me, or to contact the Louisiana.
How can geographic information systems increase citizen engagement? We will explore this and more with Professor Sukumar Ganapati of Florida International University when this special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns.
Check out the new fall-winter 2009 issue of the Business of Government magazine. Don't miss conversations with leaders. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, discusses infectious diseases such as the 2009 H1N1 flu virus and other emerging and re-emerging infectious disease. Admiral Thad Allen, commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, explains his successful use of social media tools, Coast Guard modernization, and the U.S. Arctic policy. Order or download a free copy of the Fall-Winter 2009 The Business of Government magazine by going to thebusinessofgovernment.org.
What is the Secure Communities Program? How is U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement transforming how it identifies and removes criminal aliens from the U.S.? What about its efforts to improve information sharing with its law enforcement partners? The Business of Government Hour will explore these questions and more with David Venturella, Executive Director, Secure Communities Program within the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas to improve government effectiveness. I'd like to welcome our next guest, Professor Sukumar Ganapati, author of the IBM Center report, Using Geographic Information Systems to Increase Citizen Engagement. Professor, would you describe for us geographic information systems?
Sure. Geographic information systems, which is what GIS stands for. These are a whole set of technology tools that show the spatial information visually, and we can use it also to conduct spatial analysis. This is useful because when we show things on map, they are understandable to people very easily. As you know, pictures speak 1,000 words. So in very simple terms, it's something which analyzes spatial information.
In your report, you trace the evolution of the use of geographic information systems, GIS, in government, with a focus on the use of GIS by local government. Could you give us a sense of the evolution of these systems?
There are three waves that I identified in the report, and this is broadly what I think of as the evolution of the GIS technology. The first wave is that of the traditional desktop GIS, which is essentially standalone GIS accessible to only the person who is working on that particular computer. But since then, because of the internet and the explosion of the internet in 1990s, GIS was adapted to the internet into a second wave, what I call the web GIS. The web GIS operates on something that operates on the internet, but it requires a server which is dedicated for that purpose from the organization. So if an agency were to show some spatial information, it would need to set up a server for that particular purpose. But Coming from that to the third wave is what I call the adaptation of GIS to the Web 2.0 era, what I call the Geospatial Web 2.0 platform, where the GIS tools are being used through platforms like Google Maps, Google Earth, where spatial information could be mashed up with these platforms.
The focus of your report, Professor, is on the prospects of geospatial Web 2.0 platform for citizen-oriented public services. Would you outline the four substantial areas of citizen-oriented services using GIS applications?
The four areas that I highlighted in the report are, first, the citizen-oriented transit information. Transit involves essentially buses, trains, and other forms of public transit. And what the Geospatial Web has been adapted to in that sense is to give real-time information about routes, stops, when bus or train would arrive at a particular place. And users can do that interactively over the phone or over the computer. The second application is that of the citizen relationship management, which is essentially used in local government 311 services. Here, the geospatial web is used along with other kinds of applications to provide real-time information on services and also for citizens to report any kinds of physical issues. And in this sense, although the local governments are not as advanced, there are a number of nonprofit agencies which have also come up to provide that particular service. A very good example of that comes out of UK called fixmystreet.com. But a similar kind of organizations have also come up in US. One of them is the cclickfix.com, which is essentially a platform for people to report physical problems. A third use is that of the voluntary geographic information. What VGI is, and this is a term coined by Michael Goodchild, a well-known geographer at UC Santa Barbara, it is the use of web to create, assemble, and disseminate geographic information voluntarily by individuals. So people can upload information about a particular place, and this lends itself very well to participatory GIS. And participatory GIS is very helpful in an environment where governments are not able to fund mapping projects as much. A fourth use which I talk about is that of the use of geospatial web in planning and decision making. However, the use of Geospatial Web 2.0 in this particular area is not as advanced as the other three areas. There is still scope for growth in this particular area. One good example of this, which I highlight, is that of the Portland Metro's Build a System tool, which was a tool developed for Portland Metro to plan for high-capacity transit over the next 40 years. And if we go to the web, people can choose the kind of routes which would be planned for over the next 40 years so that this particular information goes to the decision makers and they can make a more informed decision.
Great, Professor. One part of your report, which I found very interesting, picks up on the idea of citizen participation in decision making. Would you outline for us some of the challenges and, in fact, some of the opportunities for the future of GIS-enabled citizen participation in decision-making?
GIS-enabled participation and decision-making has enormous opportunities in this particular area of planning and decision-making. Technologically, there are several opportunities. And, in fact, I don't think there are as much of technological problems as there are other institutional problems. And those kinds of challenges have been highlighted by a number of others too, some of which essentially comes down to the organizational context in which the GIS is adopted. and public participation is also envisaged. So in that sense, it's more an issue of how the organization views public participation rather than a technical problem of the GIS itself. If the organization values public participation, GIS can be installed for the spatial decision-making processes. But more than that, also there are other kinds of challenges. There could be legal challenges. That is, this is a new technology. The processes for these have not yet been very well structured or set up. So this is a new terrain. So we have to look at what the legal implications of that would be. Another challenge would be that of digital divide, not necessarily in terms of people not having access to the internet or the GIS technology, but in terms of using that technology to make more informed decision making on the part of the public. A third and fourth challenge is that of the technology, not in terms of the GIS technology itself, but in terms of standards, that there are not very well established standards yet for all of the things which we do on the GIS. And we can see that especially in the spatial data infrastructure. A number of local governments have started to do that, but we have to look at how that evolves over the next few years. A last challenge is that of the governance. As I was saying before, it really depends on the organizational culture. So if the organization does value participation, implementing GIS for the spatial component of those decisions would be much easier.
Professor, it's a very timely topic and a very interesting topic. We are so filled with so much information and data. The ability to overlay it geospatially actually makes the analytics even more understandable in my mind. What prompted you to pursue research in this area?
There has been research which has been going on in this particular area. As you know, GIS is considered more of a technology, but since the 90s, there has also been an effort to look at how this technology is being used in the public domain and how participation happens. And there's a whole area of public participation, GIS, which has evolved out of that, where a number of geographers and planners are interested in. I myself am a planner, but I'm in the public administration department. And when I looked at this from the government perspective, and especially the local government perspective, I thought there was not so much of an attention being paid from a public administration perspective as to how GIS could be adopted by local governments for public participation. So it's that particular gap that I was trying to fill out here in this report.
Professor, are there specific applications of GIS technology at the local level that really illustrates perfectly its potential and valuable use?
That's the interesting part. There is really no local government yet which fully captures all of the technological capabilities of GIS to get public participation. Even Portland Metro, which I do highlight as a good case, they only went so far. That is, they used the GIS for providing the spatial information, but they did not use the GIS to get the people's preferences on routes directly. And I'm sure Portland Metro had good reasons. I did speak with one of the representatives from Portland Metro, and he did mention some of those reasons. Yet, as we go forward, I think that's one of those areas that we will see being developed further. I hope there would be a number of other local governments which will start to adopt this. And I think there could be those cities which are more technologically advanced, not only in terms of the government, but also with people, as in San Francisco, which would adopt this for a public participation process. But we have to see that evolve. And I have not seen yet a case where there is a full use of the capabilities of the Geospatial Web 2.0.
Professor, let's transition to the future. Would you outline for us what you see are the future trends in the application of geospatial Web 2.0 platforms?
The three trends in the future for the GIS are, well, the very first being the increased transparency. That is, as local governments and even state governments perhaps adapt to the Web 2.0 world, and with the openness of government, these agencies would make available the geospatial data available to the public in a direct standard format. The standardization of the format is an issue. For example, in transit world, it has been sorted out with the general transit feed specification, what used to be the Google Transit feed specification, the GTFS. Similar kinds of standards have to evolve for the other areas for making the geospatial data available. Second area is that of engaging citizens. That is, with the volunteer geographic information, there is good prospects for the local governments to tap into that kind of a voluntary information from the field, which could potentially reduce the effort that the local governments have to put for identifying the physical problems and going out into the field. A third area is that of increasing participation. As we talked earlier, that this is one of the areas which is not fully developed. So there is tremendous scope for adapting the Geospatial Web 2.0 for increasing participation. And there are likely to be far more cities which could be engaged in this kind of activity.
Professor, that's a wonderful perspective, and I want to thank you for joining us today. Your report continues the IBM Center's long-term interest in enhancing citizen participation in government decision-making, and we hope this report serves as a useful tool and informative introduction to the potential use of geographic information systems as a tool to improve citizen participation in government at all levels.
The scope of the GIS is increasing very, very fast, and things change. Even since I wrote the report, there have been additional platforms that have come up, which is quite interesting. So this is a very, very fast area of growth.
I hope you've enjoyed the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improve government effectiveness with Dr. David Wild, Dr. Vicky Grant, and Professor Sukumar Ganapati. You may order or download a free copy of each report profiled on today's show at businessofgovernment.org. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. and visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
Check out the new Fall/Winter 2009 issue of the Business of Government magazine. Don't miss conversations with leaders. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, discusses infectious diseases such as the 2009 H1N1 flu virus and other emerging and re-emerging infectious disease. Admiral Thad Allen, commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, explains his successful use of social media tools, Coast Guard modernization, and the U.S. Arctic policy. Order or download a free copy of the Fall/Winter 2009 The Business of Government magazine by going to thebusinessofgovernment.org.
What is the Secure Communities Program? How is U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement transforming how it identifies and removes criminal aliens from the U.S.? What about its efforts to improve information sharing with its law enforcement partners? The Business of Government Hour will explore these questions and more with David Venturella, Executive Director, Secure Communities Program within the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics and your source for federal news now.
CNN Radio, I'm Jim Ribble. Top story this hour, two New Jersey men appeared in federal